In the book of Joshua, we're going now to Joshua 10. We will read the first 15 verses. Now, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and had totally destroyed it, doing to Ai and his king as he had done to Jericho and its king. And the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel and were living near them. He and his people were very much alarmed at this, because Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was larger than Ai, and all its men were good fighters. So Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhiah, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Egon. "Come up and help me attack Gibeon," he said, "because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites." Then the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Egon, joined forces. They moved up with all their troops and took up positions against Gibeon and attacked it. The Gibeonites then sent word to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us." So Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. The Lord threw them into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road going up to Beth Horon and cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makkedah. As they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon to Azekah, the Lord hurled large hailstones down on them from the sky. More of them died from the hailstones than were killed by the swords of the Israelites. On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "O sun, stand still over Gibeon, O moon, over the valley of Ajalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the nations avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jasher. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. This is God's word. Can we open our Bibles? Joshua 10. Let's read verse 14. Well, it's a big verse, isn't it? "There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel." Last Thursday evening, I found myself in a prayer meeting. It was a prayer meeting, largely of one or two ministers and one or two elders. We met in the Free North Vestry, and we were praying for a specific issue. And, you know, it was a great night. There we were, just a bunch of kind of middle-aged guys in this room praying to God. I love prayer meetings. I really do love prayer meetings. And I don't know what it is in a church culture that makes folks so nervous and tetchy about prayer meetings. You know, it's just a group of folk meeting together to pray and to speak to God. It is not complex. It is not weird. It is not bizarre. And it is natural that the people of God come together to pray. Now, what is a prayer meeting? Well, the prayer meeting that we're seeing here in Joshua 10 is really inspirational. One of the reasons that I love prayer meetings is sometimes not just to pray myself, but to listen to men and women beside me pray. And there is nothing more affirmative and inspiring than listening to a woman or a man just pray to God and to access great resources. What about the resources we see here? Well, I don't know if you've ever heard of shock and awe. Shock and awe is a military term devised by the National Defense University in Washington, employed by the U.S. in Iraq. Between 300 and 400 cruise missiles fell on Baghdad in 2 days. That is more than the entire military force that fell in the previous Gulf War I. It was really absolutely incredible. If you take the most powerful military force in the world, and that's the USA, the USA military power is bigger than the 14 powers behind it. Most of the allies is more powerful than the next 14 powers put together. The U.S. military power is absolutely incredible. I wrote this down. They are investing in America $1.45 trillion to develop and operate the F-35. That's an airplane. Now, that is more than any other country, including the U.S., spends in 1 year, and it's invested in one plane, a fighter plane, the F-35. Now, I don't know if you're interested in war and into military things, but that is pretty impressive. Shock and awe, firepower. But you know, that's absolutely nothing compared to the firepower we're seeing here in Joshua 10. That just moves into insignificance. The Pentagon may have great power, but they cannot stop the sun and they cannot stop the moon. They certainly cannot stop the earth. We'll look at that a bit later. So we're looking here at this passage and we ask ourselves, well, can prayer change things? What are our prayer meetings? What are our times of prayer? As we ourselves just pray to God, can it actually affect any change? And what's it all about? Or have our prayer times descended into some kind of traditional gathering, or are they men and women meeting together to access divine power, which is quite extraordinary? Here we have two polar opposites, don't you? We have it in the verse there when it says in verse 14, the Lord listened to a man. These are the two ends of the pole, the Lord of the universe, and men and women. God listened to a man. But what I want to do this evening is just to look at 4 points here, 4 points about prayer that emerge from a text in Joshua chapter 10, common elements in our prayer life. The first common element is the element of difficulties. Difficulties. Do you see it there? Look at verse 6. It says, don't abandon us. It says in verse 8, do not be afraid. What's happening? Israel is on the rise. We've seen that. God has turned them from wanderers into worshippers. They've moved forward. They've destroyed Ai in Jericho. They made an alliance with the Gibeonites. We saw that 2 weeks ago. But the surrounding kings were nervous. Look at verse 5. They gather together in a coalition, and we've got all their names there. Exotic names. Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. And in verse 5, they started to attack the Gibeonites. When the people of God are on the move, the opposing factions move in for the kill. When the church of God is doing something, there's always opposition. When the church of God is nothing more than an extension of a political party, when the church of God sits like a mouse Everybody's quite happy for it. They like its old buildings to be museum pieces. They like its clergy dressed in nice colourful dresses, saying mumbo jumbo that people don't understand. They like all the religious paraphernalia. They like a village church, just the same as they like a village post office and a village pub. And as long as everybody is nice, everybody's happy. But the kingdom of Israel weren't nice. They were moving forward in power. They were dominating the land. They were annihilating the Canaanites. God was evidently behind them, and they were doing something that was shaking the culture of their day. And that's what happens when the church is silent. Everybody's happy. But when the church speaks with a prophetic voice, when it says, thus says the Lord, when it speaks out against things which are clearly wrong, then you get opposition that you have here. So people were coming together, and it's funny how even intolerant people can be. And I see this all the time, as I'm sure you are, that the most liberally minded people and the most tolerant people begin to get angry whenever the church of God is no longer a poodle, whenever it turns into the lion of the tribe of Judah, whenever it roars. Well, it was roaring here in Joshua chapter 10. And so Gibeon, the Gibeonites, so they were panicking. They said, we're doomed. We are for it here. We're going to be annihilated. There were difficulties. And so they needed Joshua to come to give encouragement. Now, notice when it says there, verse 6, the Gibeonites said, come up to us quickly and save us. You see the difficulties there? Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us. They are coming. There were difficulties. There was panic. Contrast verse 6 with verse 25, when Joshua says, do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Be strong and courageous. And so in verse 9, Joshua marched the army there, and God did amazing things among them. Now, there's an issue here that the armies of Israel absolutely hammered them. Look at verse 35. They totally destroyed them. Verse 30, he left no survivors. Verse 37, they left no survivors. Verse 39, everyone in it, they totally destroyed. And again and again and again, verse after verse. Now, there's another issue. Why did God do that? Well, we've got to remember, Genesis 15:16 says that the Amorites, and they were among the Canaanites, their iniquity had reached its full measure. These were incredibly bad people. There was a regime here that would make ISIS seem like, Islamic State seem like toys. These people were conducting desperate atrocities, and they had to be dealt with. Now, there's another question, indeed another sermon in that, and that's for another day. But we find here that the people are pushed aside and all these difficulties are arising. They are in God's will. No doubt about that. Whatever you may think of it, the morality or the politics, the Canaanite, the children of Israel and the Gibeonites who were in alliance with them were in God's will, and yet they still experienced these difficulties. Do you get the point? The point is that when we are living in God's will, it does not exempt us from difficulties. Indeed, rather, sometimes it brings us into difficulties. And so don't misinterpret difficulties in your life just now. The difficulties that you are experiencing, and I don't know what they are, is not a sign that you're out. It could be a sign that you're in. And indeed, the psalmist said, I envy the wicked because they don't have any hassle. They are at ease. They don't seem to have any trouble. But we find here that the difficulties drove them to their knees. Difficulties. This shows us one of the real benefits of problems. Now, that's revolutionary. The benefits of problems? Is that what some of us need to hear this evening? Psalm 119. It says, "It was good for me to be afflicted." Why? "That I may learn your decrees. The law from your mouth is more precious to me than thousands of pieces of silver and gold." So difficulties make us pray. Difficulties draw us to God. Difficulties make us learn sometimes the purpose, the law of God, the way God works. Martha Lane Fox is a very interesting character. I followed her progress. She's now 41 years of age. Martha Lane Fox, in her 20s, was the founder of lastminute.com. She sold it for $13 million in 2005, which is really sweetie money these days for a dot-com company. But, you know, she made a lot of money. Martha Lane Fox was very privileged. She had very famous parents. About 5 years ago, she almost died in a road accident in Morocco. She broke 28 bones in her body, and she suffered a stroke. Now, that's difficulties. With all the money in the world, still she went downhill and downhill. She broke her back. She thought at one point she wasn't able to live. Martha Lane Fox experienced difficulties in her life. She wrote this: "I am still fundamentally the same person. People say, surely some good came out of it. Have you refocused your life? No, actually. No good has come out of it. It's entirely rubbish at all levels." She didn't use the word rubbish, but I didn't think it appropriate to use the word that she used. See, that's the difference. There is a woman in the world, and she goes through that, a near-death experience in their accident in Morocco. "Martha, what have you learned?" "Nothing." The same person. The Gibeonites, what have they learned with their difficulties? They've learned that they need God. They've learned that they are really lost without God. What about us in our own lives? John Piper has that great expression, "Don't waste your cancer." You understand what he means? Some of you do. Don't waste your cancer. It could have been easily, "Don't waste your bankruptcy." It could have been, "Don't waste your loss. Don't waste your mourning." In other words, things happen to us, and it's not a cliche to say that they can either make us better or bitter. We can invest our lives in bitterness. What if, what if, what if? Or we can invest our lives in betterment. So there we have difficulties. But the second thing we notice here are promises. Promises. Look at verse 12. Joshua prays. He prays to God. And the basis for his prayer is not in verse 12, but the prayer of verse 12 is based on verse 8. "The Lord said to them, 'Do not be afraid of him. I have given him into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you.'" Notice the tense there. "I have given them into your hand." The perfect is used before it even happens. It is a done deal. And Joshua is praying there of the promises of God seen in verse 15. Now, Joshua learned some lessons. We saw 2 weeks ago that, remember, with the Gibeonites, he didn't inquire in the Lord, and he was taken in by their deception. A chapter's moved on. He's now inquired of the Lord. He's leaning in the Lord. His trust is in the Lord, and his trust is in the promises of God. The promises of God, the great promises of God that he has made. You know, we can go through life with or without God, without consulting him, or we can consult him. We can go on our own strength. Former heavyweight boxer James Quick Tillis. Interesting character. Google him. James Tillis. He was from Oklahoma, and he was destined to be a world-class boxer. So he lived in this city, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he set off on his world travels. And his first leg of his journey was simply taking the bus, the Greyhound bus, from Tulsa to Chicago. And Tillis tells the story. He gets into the Windy City. He gets into Chicago. And he says to himself, I am going to take over the world. First Chicago, then the world. He wrote this. I got off the bus with two cardboard suitcases under my arm in downtown Chicago. I put them down in front of the Sears Towers. And I looked up at the tower and said to myself, I'm going to conquer Chicago. When I looked down, my suitcases were gone. You see, he thought he was going to conquer the world, but he was robbed in Chicago. Even in the very first stage, he thought that he was invincible, but he fell at the first hurdle. Folk, we are susceptible to that also. We are susceptible to that unless we're leaning on bigger promises, unless we're leaning on the providence of God. Now, notice the way God deals with us. He promises us. He promised Joshua. We've seen what these promises are in verse 8. John Calvin says, God stimulates us more powerfully to the performance of duty than promising, than by ordering. I don't know if you agree with Calvin there, but he says, God stimulates us more by promising than ordering. That's the way human psychology goes. The carrot, the stick. What a carrot. The promises of God. The promises of God. I've been fiddled on two occasions knowingly. Number one was in fourth year in school when someone who shall remain nameless said, David, can I get a dinner ticket? I'll pay you back tomorrow. I'm still waiting. And I'm still remembering. Next time I see him, I'll ask for my dinner ticket back. The other time was in the church here. A guy came in with a sob story. Now, I'm from Paisley. I'm not normally taken in. I'm cynical. But I was taken in. Boy, I was taken in by the guy. He told this sob story. And I took him out for lunch. We got him a bed in a hotel for the night. And he was a con man. He was jailed for doing that to about 5-6 churches. The guy he was a serial career con. You know, it's very easy to be conned by these people. They make promises. They're not worth anything. But when the God of the universe makes promises, I will never leave you or forsake me. I will be with you always. I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. When God makes promises, they cannot be broken. Now, this changes our prayer life. Prayer is not extracting benefits from an unwilling God. He's a benefactor. It's digging up God's treasures. He wants us to thrive. He wants his church to grow. I will build my church, he says. These are the promises. God speaks just through the Bible. Are you in despair? Turn to the promises. When you pass through the water, I will be with you. Going through a tunnel just now? Going through an experience of darkness? Walking through the shadow of death? The promises, I will be with you. Walking through that valley with you. Sure, we've seen the difficulties. But let's listen to the promises. And Joshua had seen God do it all before. He took Ai. He'd seen the walls of Jericho collapse. God had done it. We see difficulties. We see promises. What's the third thing we see here? It's faith. It's faith. What emerges here is a picture of great faith. Verse 12 is very specific. O sun, stand still over Gibeon. O moon, over the valley of Aijalon. Oh, now, I know that the cosmology is just a figure of speech, okay? I know that the earth goes round the sun. We know that. It's just a figure of speech. He's basically asking for time to stop. Okay, it's just a moon stop, sun stop. Let time stop. Now, this is leadership. This is leadership. Joshua prays a big prayer. It's public. He said to the Lord, see that in verse 12, in the presence of Israel. He's got a great expectation before a great God, and he's got the faith to say to the people, I'm going to pray for time to stop. Because, yeah, they were in a battle and they needed more time. This is a prayer. It is something which is so great that it is beyond his power, and it's even beyond reason itself. It's beyond all these things. But he knows God, and he knows that God can do it. He asks for a miracle. Read C.S. Lewis in Miracles, great book. C.S. Lewis says, miracles is a retelling in small letters of the very same story that's written in large letters over the whole world. The letters are too large for us to see. In other words, C.S. Lewis says, we operate in miracle all the time. We just don't see it. We really do. I mean, what is the earth? A big lump of stone suspended. It's a miracle. Why do the planets not bump into one another? You know, it's a miracle. Gravity. Why are we not all floating about this evening, chained down to the floor? Well, you say it's gravity. Physicists say that. But the whole thing is God. God's doing it. He's working in a miraculous way. It's large letters. God is saying, I am God. I do the miraculous all the day. And a miracle is just, Lewis says, in small letters, just what God does all the time. There's nothing for God to stop time, but it's a big prayer, isn't it? God is saying, look at what I can do. This is faith. Big faith covets big things, areas where we are absolutely in the impossibility. There are people here tonight who should have been dead years ago, according to the calculations, and here we are, most of us breathing, most of us have a pulse. It's a miracle that many of us are here at all for other reasons. We could have been swept away into some disaster or other, and here we are. It's a miracle. Faith. It's not that we need great faith. It's just that we need small faith in a great God. Great faith is not really all that much in evidence, but you know, faith in a great God is all that we need. Martin Luther, the reformer, had a good friend and an assistant called Friedrich Myconius. Myconius, in 1540, he was on his deathbed. He was expected to die. You didn't send a text in those days. You didn't send an email. You didn't go on to WhatsApp with a message. You sent a letter. And so on his deathbed, Myconius sent a tender deathbed letter to Luther, thanking him for all that he'd done, and Myconius said, I'm about to die. Luther wrote back, and he wrote these words, I command you in the name of God to live. I still have need of you in the work of reforming the church. The Lord will never let me hear that you are dead, but will permit you to survive me. For this I am praying, this is my will, and may my will be done, because I seek only to glorify the name of God. Myconius lived for 6 more years, and indeed outlived Luther by 2 months. That's faith. And that's what made men like Luther pray with power. What do you think about that? Wouldn't you like to be able to pray like that? I would. Difficulties, promises, faith. And then finally, we see here effort. Effort. Verse 8 is the revealed will of God. The Lord said to Joshua, don't be afraid of him. I have given him into your hand. It's a slam dunk. It's a done deal. God says, I'm going to give all these kings, these coalition kings, I am going to hammer them. This was fixed before the foundation of the world. This is what we believe, isn't it? Divine sovereignty. God has a plan. The kings are going to be annihilated. So, given that fact, why did Joshua even get out of bed that morning? He thought, well, if it's God's will, it's God's will. That's not how it works. That is not how it works. This is not just Calvinism, this is Biblicism. See, this is where we have a mystery. We've got, if God is God, God is clearly sovereign over all things. Surely that is the very definition of God. That if there is anything that is out with the control of God, then that person could itself be God. Because God, to be God, must be all powerful. And so he is. Verse 8, I'm going to give him into your hands. But it's followed by a 12 and a half mile hike as the soldiers get boots on the ground and head off to give the kings of the Amorites, Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Egon, to give them a bit of a hammering. Here we have a great illustration, and this is in history. Max Weber, the great sociologist, has got that famous book about the growth of capitalism and its link up with Calvinism. These early pioneers that come out of the Reformation, how did they build countries? How did they build the economy of countries? By sitting back and being fatalistic? No, they trusted in God and they kept their powder dry. They trusted in God's will and they worked and they worked and they worked. They put effort into it. Ralph Davis says that divine reassurance does not stifle, but stimulates human ingenuity. And so we see that there's real effort here. God's comfort doesn't sedate, but stimulates the disciples' activity. And God unfolds his providence in answer to prayer. So there's got to be real effort put in here. Never make divine sovereignty an excuse for human sluggishness. That great Pauline expression, make every effort. Make every effort. Folks, tonight, if you're not saved, it's your fault. It's your fault. It's not God's. Don't blame God for your lack of willing power. Make every effort. And look what happened. The sun stood still. God did it. Now, could God do something as great for us? He's done greater. He has done greater. He has provided one greater than Joshua, Hebrews 7:25, whoever lives to make intercession for us. And so tonight, yes, the application is our prayer life is stronger, but also there's a deeper application that points us to Christ, and his prayer life for us is so much more important, or certainly as important as our prayer life to him. You know that hymn, from the Father's side he pleads, five bleeding wounds he bears, received in Calvary, They pour effectual prayers. They strongly plead for me. Forgive him, oh forgive, they cry. Nor let that ransomed sinner die. Christ is praying for us. Folks, tonight, what about our prayer lives? Are you going through difficulties? Don't let them push you from God. The bumps are what we climb on. Remember his precious promises? Faith. You don't need big faith. You just need faith in a big God. Effort. Make every effort. You may not require the sun and the moon to stop. You may not require time to stop. But there is something in your life you want to pray for. There is someone in your life you want to pray for. There is a situation in your life you want to pray for. There is an impossibility that you are facing. Faith laughs at impossibilities and says, it shall be done. Let's pray.